So we're roughly two-thirds of the way through this chapter on life, the 19th in the Life Divine. He began the chapter by noting that it is mind's special action in extending forward the supramental creative activity into form so as to hold them apart and establish them in relationship with each other. So in a way, it could be considered the final act in completing the creative manifestation authored by the supermind, bringing into rich presentation in a cosmos the infinity of Satchit Ananda. Life is a specialized action of that power which is the mind. And what Sri Aurobindo is now trying to convey to us up to this point is that life is a universal power. Obviously, we detect it in animality. We detect it also in the plant. And Sri Aurobindo has been suggesting that because life pervades all the universe, that the power of life being identical in plant and an animal might be discoverable in what is inert, in what is sheerly material as well, or as we regard it from our perspective, what seems to be absent of all consciousness and sentience. So this is the question that we stopped with last time, and to begin with that first sentence again, is there any justification for elevating this distinction into an essential difference, this distinction between life in plant and life in animal? What, for instance, is the difference between life in ourselves and life in the plant? We see that they differ. First, in our possession of the power of locomotion, which has evidently nothing to do with the essence of vitality. And secondly, in our possession of conscious sensation, which is, so far as we know, not yet evolved in the plant. Our nervous responses are largely, though by no means always or in their entirety, attended with the mental response of conscious sensation. They have a value to the mind as well as to the nerve system, and the body agitated by the nervous action. So our nervous responses are coupled to the mind. With the mind, we mark, we measure, we interpret sensory experience. Sri Aurobindo suggests that they are coupled in this way inextricably. So mind is present in the sensory activities of life. In the plant, he writes, it would seem that there are symptoms of nervous sensation, including those which should be in us rendered as pleasure and pain, waking and sleep, exhilaration, dullness and fatigue, and the body is inwardly agitated by the nervous action, but there is no sign of the actual presence of mentally conscious sensation. But sensation is sensation, whether mentally conscious or vitally sensitive, and sensation is a form of consciousness. So the point we would derive from this is that consciousness is intrinsic to the universe, and it has perforce a metaphysical and a cosmic aspect and function. To continue, when the sensitive plant shrinks from a contact, it appears that it is nervously affected, that something in it dislikes the contact and tries to draw away from it. There is, in a word, a subconscious sensation in the plant, just as there are, as we have seen, subconscious operations of the same kind in ourselves. So again, subconscious, if we're taking mind as meant, in other words, if MINT, if mind is the standard by which we decide what is conscious and what is not, it seems to be subconscious. And again, you'll remember weeks and weeks ago, we talked about Pierre Janet, a French thinker and psychologist who coined that term, subconscient. Now, it means literally what is consciousness, but not in focal awareness. So when we have focally aware consciousness, we're aware mentally. I am the subject looking at the object. That kind of awareness would be consciousness. But consciousness could be a broader spectrum, and what lies beneath that could be considered to be subconscious. Let's not make the mistake often made to think that this term subconscious, which comes from the French subconscient, I don't know how to say that correctly in French. All of you help me. But we should make the easy equation of subconscious with Freud and Jung's use of the term unconscious. There is a distinction there, and we won't go into that labyrinthine examination right now. The difference between the subconscious and the dynamic unconscious, we'll leave that for other innings if we come back to it in our look into the life divine. But this term, subconscious, we're going to see again and again, so we may as well remind ourselves of what it means. So for Sri Aurobindo, what is subconscious has not simply application to an individual organism, but again has a metaphysical context and a cosmic context, because all that is in the cosmos is derived from real being, which is conscious and whose experience of itself is delightful. So all of this, in a sense, is passed into, involved into the substance of creation. Mind empowers life. Life stirs matter, emboldens it into action. But even there is consciousness in matter, he will say. Certainly in life. And these distinctions that we want to draw between the boundaries of life present in animal and life present in plant is artificial and prejudicial. Back to his own sentences now. In the human system, it is quite possible to bring these subconscious perceptions and sensations to the surface long after they have happened and have ceased to affect the nervous system. And an ever-increasing mass of evidence has irrefutably established the existence of a subconscious mentality in us much vaster than the conscious. The mere fact that the plant has no superficially vigilant mind which can be awakened to the valuation of its subconscious sensations makes no difference to the essential identity of the phenomena. So it's the same life responding in the plant to external stimulus as would respond in the awakened mind of the human. The phenomena being the same, he says, the thing they manifest must be the same, and that thing is a subconscious mind. And it is quite possible that there is a more rudimentary life operation of the subconscious sense mind in the metal, although in the metal there is no bodily agitation corresponding to the nervous response. But the absence of bodily agitation makes no essential difference to the presence of vitality in the metal, any more than the absence of bodily locomotion makes an essential difference to the presence of vitality in the plant. The same argument applies. So, inertia does not prove absence of life. What we gather from this, then, is that universal mind in the plant is subconscious, but life is there. Universal mind in matter is more deeply subconscious, but mind and life are there. Indeed, for Sri Aurobindo's cosmic system to work, this immersion of everything in the living, the awakenable substance of Satchidananda as it stirs and evolves through the secret power above of supermind and below of supermind must be true or his whole system would fail. In other words, the divine must be immanent. I-M-M-A-N-E-N-T. You know, it must pervade this universe. So, he writes, what happens when the conscious becomes subconscious in the body, or the subconscious becomes conscious? The real difference lies in the absorption of the conscious energy in part of its work, its more or less exclusive concentration. And we can hearken back to earlier passages where Sri Aurobindo shows that it is the power of consciousness to install itself in a specific object, ignoring all the rest, which leads to the initial state of ignorance. So he continues, in certain forms of concentration, what we call the mentality, that is to say, the prajñāna, or apprehensive consciousness, almost or quite ceases to act consciously. Yet, the work of the body and the nerves and the sense mind goes on unnoticed, but constant and perfect. It has all become subconscious, and only in one activity or chain of activities is the mind luminously active. So these states of concentration, which we could say here and in a coming passage, could be equatable with nirvikalpa samadhi or even savikalpa samadhi, reflect this. We may be able to fix our consciousness in less exalted states. For instance, when we're driving a car and we're engrossed in thoughts, and all of a sudden we've arrived at our destination, parked perfectly, the car's in line with the established parking guides, and you get out and say to yourself, I wonder how I got here. Because your consciousness was really placed elsewhere, but the consciousness of the body, the consciousness of the vitality, were perfectly attuned to the task and did what was necessary. So there was awareness, else nothing could have been done at all. So this indicates, again, the universality of awareness. And where has the consciousness been placed? If we used an image of a spectrum like a radio band. You know, if we can tune down it to 88.1 and listen to good classical music on a public radio station, or we could go all the way to the other extreme, to the top of the band, and listen to shall I say, rock and roll. Anywhere along the way, we can tune the station and we get what is appropriate there. Well, the same thing is true with the spectrum of consciousness. Wherever we attune the consciousness is what we receive. The rest is going on. We're just oblivious to it. We ignore it, literally, because of the focality of our awareness. So Sri Aurobindo then takes it to the first person. While I write, the physical act of writing is largely or sometimes entirely done by the subconscious mind. The body makes unconsciously, as we say, certain nervous movements. The mind is awake only to the thought with which it is occupied. So again, here he is equating mind with direct awareness. The whole man, indeed, may sink into the subconscious, yet habitual movements implying the action of mind may continue, as in many phenomena of sleep. Or he may rise into the superconscient and yet be active with the subliminal mind in the body, as in certain phenomena of samadhi or yogic trance. So absorption below or above the line of mentation. And this is interesting, action upon the body, as he says, even in this state of trance, look again, and yet be active with the subliminal mind in the body. So one can, in a sense, station oneself in a superior state of awareness above, let's say, the rational mind, interior and above, and be able to take direct action upon the body, even from that tranced condition. The trance may not be a trance of oblivion. It may be a trance of inclusion and absorption, but from above rather than being centered in the body. So it's an extraordinary state of awareness that is exampled in that sentence. It is evident, he writes, then, that the difference between plant sensation and our sensation is simply that in the plant, the conscious force manifesting itself in the universe has not yet fully emerged from the sleep of matter, from the absorption which entirely divides the worker force from its source of work in the superconscient knowledge, and therefore does subconsciously what it will do consciously when it emerges in man from its absorption and begins to wake, though still indirectly, to its knowledge self. So again, here is a hint. When he uses the term conscious force, of course, he's referring to the chit shakti. Chit shakti, of course, will bring you back to the larger philosophic concept, and we would say spiritual reality, of Sat-Chit-Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss. But chit is never simply chit. Chit is always chit force. Chit shakti or chit tapas. And we'll come to that more momentarily. So, conscious force as chit shakti is translated into life as power. Not absent from the universe, not way up there, but here, present, acting through the veil of the life power. It does exactly the same things, but in a different way and with a different value in terms of consciousness. This, again, it does exactly the same things, but in a different way. The way is carved out by conscious force, chit shakti. And the value is the translation into experienceable terms of ananda. All of this, of course, is based on being. The universe is real. Here is the conscious force of Satchit-Ananda acting through apparently lower terms of empowerment and of formation, and yet achieving a multi-form experience which is valuable to itself, every experience having a different value, and that value is registrations of Ananda. Different terms, different degrees. And now we come to a part of this chapter where Sri Aurobindo begins to rewrite substantially what was published in the Arya back in February 1916. It is becoming possible now to conceive that in the very atom there is something that becomes in us a will and a desire. There is an attraction and repulsion which, though phenomenally other, are essentially the same thing as liking and disliking in ourselves, but are, as we say, inconscient or subconscient. This essence of will and desire are evident everywhere in nature, and though this is not yet sufficiently envisaged, they are associated with and indeed the expression of a subconscient or, if you will, inconscient or quite involved sense and intelligence, which are equally pervasive. Again, what he's referring to is the prior involution of Satchit-Ananda through the creative agency of the supramental into mind, life, and matter. Present in every atom of matter, all this is necessarily present in everything which is formed by the aggregation of those atoms. And they are present in the atom because they are present in the force which builds up and constitutes the atom. So essentially, he's bonding together, showing the ultimate unity of matter and life. That force, he says, is fundamentally the chit-tapas or chit-shakti of the Vedanta. Consciousness force, inherent conscious force of conscious being, inherent from in here. In English, it means to stick, so to stick with it. Conscious force is part of conscious being. They cannot be segregated. They cannot be separated. So, matter cannot be divided from life. Life cannot be divided from mind. All must contain consciousness. That force is fundamentally this consciousness force, which manifests itself as nervous energy full of submental sensation in the plant, as desire sense and desire will in the primary animal forms, as self-conscious sense and force in the developing animal, as mental will and knowledge topping all the rest in man. So it is this same Chit Shakti, which is registering itself in all these grades of increasing manifestation. Manifestation of what? Of itself. And here, these next few sentences and a long paragraph afterwards, Sri Aurobindo added completely to what he had written in the Arya. Life is a scale of the universal energy in which the transition from inconscience to consciousness is managed. It is an intermediary power of it latent or submerged in matter, delivered by its own force into submental being, delivered finally by the emergence of mind into the full possibility of its dynamis. So again, he's at pains to show that Sat and Chit are present in the empowerment of life. And why? this pursuit for the experience of honor. That's the value of the manifestation. Apart from all other considerations, this conclusion imposes itself as a logical necessity if we observe even the surface process of the emergence in the light of the evolutionary theme. It is self-evident that life in the plant, even if otherwise organized than in the animal, is yet the same power, marked by birth and growth and death, propagation by the seed, death by decay or malady or violence, maintenance by indrawing of nourishing elements from without, dependence on light and heat, productiveness and sterility, even states of sleep and waking, energy and depression of life dynamism, passage from infancy to maturity and age. The plant contains, moreover, the essences of the force of life and is therefore the natural food of animal existences. Back to that Upanishadic idea, the eater eating is eaten. The circle of life is complete. One contributes to another and is helped later by yet others. If it is conceded that it has a nervous system and reactions to stimuli, a beginning or undercurrent of submental or purely vital sensations, the identity becomes closer. And again, this is what J.C. Bose was demonstrating in his experience in the early part of the 20th century. But still, it remains evidently a stage of life evolution intermediate between animal existence and inanimate matter. This is precisely what must be expected if life is a force evolving out of matter and culminating in mind. And if it is that, then we are bound to suppose that it is already there in matter itself, submerged or latent in the material subconsciousness or in conscience. So life is inbuilt in matter. It has been involved there. It has spiraled down into it in the original creative act. As out of supermind came mind, mind uses life as a method of empowerment in the universe. Life involves itself into matter and so can uncoil from matter and begin the springing forward, which is the real evolution through living forms. For from where else can it emerge? Evolution of life and matter supposes a previous involution of it there, unless we suppose it to be a new creation magically and unaccountably introduced into nature. If it is that, it must either be a creation out of nothing or a result of material operations which is not accounted for by anything in the operations themselves or by any element in them which is of a kindred nature. Or conceivably, it may be a descent from above, from some superphysical plane above the material universe. So these are alternate views, which he doesn't really accept, but he's going to take this last one and tease it apart. The two first suppositions can be dismissed as arbitrary conceptions. The last explanation, descent from above, is possible, and it is quite conceivable, and in the occult view of things, true, that a pressure from some plane of life above the material universe has assisted the emergence of life here. But this does not exclude the origin of life from matter itself as a primary and necessary movement. For the existence of a life world or life plane above the material does not of itself lead to the emergence of life and matter unless that life plane exists as a formative stage in a descent of being through several grades or powers of itself into the inconscience with the result of an involution of itself with all these powers in matter for a later evolution and emergence. So there may be a life plane above us which leans down to embrace matter here and strike upon it with a nisus to wake it up and goad it into action. But if life had not already involved itself with all of its power and all of its potentialities into matter, that would be of no use. It couldn't. So it's here. And life must emerge through its own strength with whatever assistance from above. The above can't do the work for the below. The below has to provide it. That's a good lesson to us, right? If we yogins want to manifest a divine life, we have to do the work. We can't be waiting for the day when it's delivered to us, you know. We can't order it through Amazon. Whether signs of this submerged life are discoverable, unorganized yet or rudimentary in material things, or there are no such signs, because this involved life is in a full sleep, is not a question of capital importance. The material energy that aggregates, forms, and disaggregates is the same power in another grade of itself as that life energy which expresses itself in birth, growth, and death. Just as by its doing of the works of intelligence in a somnambulist subconscious, it betrays itself as the same power that in yet another grade attains the status of mind. Its very character shows that it contains in itself, though not yet in their characteristic organization or process, the yet undelivered powers of mind and life. So, packed inside matter is all this potentiality. Involved, waiting to evolve, this is an inner view of nature. And something must bridge the gap. So that's the paragraph that Sri Aurobindo added in a few sentences before that, too, to make clear what he's talking about. Because, of course, this is going to assume stronger, clearer mention in upcoming chapters, where this coordination, or you might say, deep and vast conspiracy between the superconscient and what is emerging as consciousness here could impact the future evolution on Earth. So this idea is part of the divine technology and has to be inserted here. You can see why he had to present these extra sentences. So we hit a footnote back there about aggregates, forms, and disaggregates. Let's read that. Birth, growth, and death of life are in their outward aspect the same process of aggregation, formation, and disaggregation, though more than that in their inner process and significance. So the outward aspect and the inner process and significance. Even the ensoulment of the body by the psychic being follows, if the occult view of these things is correct, a similar outward process. For the soul as nucleus draws to itself for birth and aggregates the elements of its mental, vital, and physical sheaths and their contents, increases these formations in life, and in its departing drops and disaggregates again these aggregates. Disaggregates again these aggregates, drawing back into itself its inner powers till, in rebirth, it repeats the original process. Again, he hasn't really made mention of how it is that the psychic being incarnates in the world and the method by which it gathers its materials and installs them in the incarnation it will undergo upon Earth. So this is a glimpse in advance a thumbnail sketch of what later he'll give a stronger articulation to. So back to the top, we resume with life then reveals itself as essentially the same everywhere, from the atom to man. The atom, containing the subconscious stuff and movement of being which are released into consciousness in the animal, with plant life as a midway stage in the evolution. So the same everywhere. Life, he says, is really a universal operation of conscious force acting subconsciously on and in matter. It is the operation that creates, maintains, destroys, and recreates forms or bodies and attempts by play of nerve force, that is to say, by currents of interchange of stimulating energy, to awake conscious sensation in those bodies. In this operation, there are three stages. The lowest is that in which the vibration is still in the sleep of matter, entirely subconscious, so as to seem wholly mechanical. The middle stage is that in which it becomes capable of a response still submental, but on the verge of what we know as consciousness. The highest is that in which life develops conscious mentality in the form of a mentally perceptible sensation, which in this transition becomes the basis for the development of sense mind and intelligence. So, sleep, a submental response, and then conscious mentality are the three stages. It is in the middle stage that we catch the idea of life as distinguished from matter and mind. But in reality, it is the same in all the stages and always a middle term between mind and matter, constituent of the latter and instinct with the former. It is an operation of conscious force which is neither the mere formation of substance nor the operation of mind with substance and form as its object of apprehension. It is rather an energizing of conscious being which is a cause and support of the formation of substance and an intermediate source and support of conscious mental apprehension. Life, as this intermediate energizing of conscious being, liberates into sensitive action and reaction, a form of the creative force of existence which was working subconsciently or inconsciently, absorbed in its own substance. Paying attention, when he refers to the creative force of existence, and this being an operation of conscious force, implies the presence of the supramental, even within the life force itself. I'm going to read that entire sentence. Life, as this intermediate energizing of conscious being, of course, Sat-Chit, liberates into sensitive action and reaction a form of the creative force of existence, possibly insinuating supermind here, which was working subconsciently or inconsciently, absorbed in its own substance. It supports and liberates into action the apprehensive consciousness of existence called mind. Remember how the apprehending third or second poise of the supramental extends itself into what we call mind and supports mind in the furtherance of its goal of diversification. So again, apprehensive consciousness of existence called mind, and gives it a dynamic instrumentation so that it can work not only on its own forms, but on forms of life and matter. It connects to and supports, as a middle term between them, the mutual commerce of the two, mind and matter. This means of commerce, life provides in the continual currents of her pulsating nerve energy, which carry force of the form as a sensation to modify mind and bring back force of mind as will to modify matter. It is therefore this nerve energy which we usually mean when we talk of life. It is the prana or life force of the Indian system. So you see, these elements of creation being used as the stuff, the material by which things are brought into formation, and as that upon which one reacts and brings back the substance of the experience to the budding consciousness for its development. And to further modify matter so that it become a better and better house and more sophisticated vehicle in which consciousness can ride and manifest. But nerve energy, he writes, is only the form it takes in the animal being. The same pranic energy is present in all forms down to the atom, since everywhere it is the same in essence, and everywhere it is the same operation of conscious force. Force supporting and modifying the substantial existence of its own forms. Force with sense and mind secretly active, but at first involved in the form and preparing to emerge, then finally emerging from their involution. This is the whole significance of the omnipresent life that is manifested and inhabits the material universe. So we can see that these powers, which seem to be involved and separable, seem to be dimmed in consciousness, dimmed into insentience, from which subconscious awakening occurs, leading to a fuller consciousness in the mind, and then leading us forward from there up the stairway until we can regain the superconscious of our native selves. Behind all of it stands this grand harmony of Sat-Chit-Ananda, active even through the powers of life and matter as the conscious force that dominates all existence. To go back to those words from Sri Aurobindo's other book, The Mother, written upon the establishment of the ashram, an experiment in building a life divine, no? So, life energizes this conscious force in matter. It's the way conscious force wakes up matter, is through the life power. And life dynamizes, brings into formation, releases secret powers, unfolds the operation of the senses, stirs into wakefulness the mind, building upon the senses, mediating all the time between the lowest apparent rung, matter, and then that rung where we begin to reach back to full consciousness, mind. It is that which connects the two, vivifies matter, empowers mind. And then life's power further releases and drives forward the process, the evolution of consciousness upon earth, releasing that power which is enclosed in the forms. Remember how mind holds apart all forms? Life's job is to then stir those forms and to release the sleeping energies within. And its first stirring is this pranic element. We call it life. It is a larger, a more universal power than that, and always a masked form of the chit shakti, of the conscious power. This would bear some comparison with the Sankhya scheme, but I think that we've gone far enough tonight and we'll save that for future innings. The 20th chapter, Death, Desire, and Incapacity, awaits us next week, and we'll take that up then. I think we can continue reading from Savitri tonight with a passage succeeding the one we read last week. Again, we're in the Book of Beginnings here, in the canto, The Secret Knowledge. All here, where each thing seems its lonely self, are figures of the soul transcendent one. Only by him they are, his breath is their life. An unseen presence molds the oblivious clay. A playmate in the mighty mother's game, one came upon the dubious whirling globe to hide from her pursuit in force and form. A secret spirit in the inconscient sleep, a shapeless energy, a voiceless word. He was here before the elements could emerge, before there was light of mind or life could breathe. Accomplice of her cosmic huge pretense, his semblances he turns to real shapes and makes the symbol equal with the truth. He gives to his timeless thoughts a form in time. He is the substance, he the self of things. She has forged from him her works of skill and might. She wraps him in the magic of her moods and makes of his myriad truths her countless dreams. The master of being has come down to her, an immortal child born in the fugitive years. In objects wrought, in the persons she conceives, dreaming, she chases her idea of him, and catches here a look, and there a jest. Ever he repeats in them his ceaseless births. He is the maker and the world he made. He is the vision and he is the seer. He is himself the actor and the act. He is himself the knower and the known. He is himself the dreamer and the dream. There are two who are one and play in many worlds. In knowledge and ignorance they have spoken and met, and light and darkness are their eyes interchange. Our pleasure and pain are their wrestle and embrace. Our deeds, our hopes are intimate to their tale. They are married secretly in our thought and life. The universe is an endless masquerade, for nothing here is utterly what it seems. It is a dream fact vision of a truth, which, but for the dream, would not be wholly true. A phenomenon stands out significant against dim backgrounds of eternity. We accept its face and pass by all it means. A part is seen. We take it for the whole. Thus have they made their play with us for roles. Author and actor with himself as seen, he moves there as the soul, as nature she. Namaste. Jai Ma.